Welcome to Holden Village. Today in the Fireside Room, Rory Miller will be speaking about American westering, space, and yearning. So let's listen in on Rory.
I'd just like to begin, first of all, with the quote in your syllabus by Balboa. In 1513, wrote to Ferdinand of Spain, "A man arrives as far as he can and not as far as he wishes." And that sort of sums up what I'm going to be talking about. And another quote by T.S. Eliot, who says, "We shall not cease from exploration, and the end of all our exploring will be to arrive where we started and know the place for the first time." My starting point today is not to suggest that we've arrived back where we've begun, but I think that may be a part of what the journey is about. I've said at the beginning of each session that the overall topic that I'm speaking about is geopiety, and by that I mean a faith that is grounded in our surroundings. Just as we are grounded in time and history, we are grounded and shaped by the space in which we live. And that space shapes our personalities and shapes our spiritual lives. Yesterday, we talked about childhood memories and place. And it was very interesting. In the course of the class, we drew diagrams of our childhood homes. And what was very powerful was, for some people, memories from age 4 of the place they, in great detail, and the kind of emotion and power that still carries with it, just that memory, I think does suggest that there's something about those early memories and those early places that shape our spiritual life and our lives today. In fact, it wasn't just childhood home that came out. There was the whole neighborhood, the places that you could go and the places you couldn't go. And there was the church, and there was the school bus ride. And in all of those places still having meaning for us as adults. I wanted to offer the opportunity, was anyone here yesterday who did a diagram who didn't get a chance to talk about it, who would like to say something today? I felt badly because we kind of ran out of time. And probably those people have left Holden by now. But I'd like, also yesterday I gave two short stories. One is called The Enchanted Bluff by Willa Cather, and the other is The Leader of the People by John Steinbeck. If you haven't read those and would like a copy, you can take copies with you. And I'd like to just give a little bit of introduction about Willa Cather, and if anyone has comments about their reading of The Enchanted Bluff, we'll spend a little bit of time on that. Willa Cather was a native Nebraskan, and she, in her early writings, expressed a sense of being stifled in her early childhood in the small town life. And you see that a lot in her early writings, in themes of there being corruption and conflict in these small towns. Everyone knows about everything. And as you read her writings, it isn't until she is an adult and goes to New Mexico and encounters in the vast New Mexican landscape a spiritual connection and a real sense of place and sense of being in sacred space in that land, that she is able to come back to Nebraska and then write about her own home land, which is also vast. And she comes to some peace, and you can see in her writings a sense of appreciation that are not there in the early ones. The Enchanted Bluff is a story written from the point of view of a young man about to leave his hometown, Sandtown, and he's had this glorious summer with his boyhood friends, And this story she wrote at a time when you can tell that she still wasn't quite at peace with her hometown. And one of the themes that comes through strongly is yearning for travel in exotic places. And another interesting theme is it tells the story of the boys in the summer and their ambitions, and the center of their excitement is a story that one of the boys, Tip, tells about an enchanted bluff in New Mexico that his uncle had told him about, where there, and I think this is an actual place. Has anyone heard of this place before?
I think so.
I read about this somewhere, and I can't remember where, so I'm pretty sure it's a real place in New Mexico. But it's a giant monolithic cliff that is inaccessible by walking, that an ancient tribe of people lived upon. It was big enough for there to be a very small community on the cliff. And they had a ladder that hung down, and they could come down and gather what they needed, but then they actually stored the food they needed, and it was the most safe place they could be. and I think it was a fairly peaceful tribe. Well, what happened was, when the men and the tribe and the boys were down to gather more food, a war party came and killed them. And oh, I know what happened. The ladder was broken by the time they came back. And when they came back to the bluff, there was no access. And while they were trying to figure out how they were going to get back up, another war party from another tribe came and killed them. And then the people left above eventually died too. And so archaeologists had since explored and found relics of this tribe. In the short story, the boys who are telling the story, who have been enchanted by tales of distant lands, just think this is the epitome of an exciting place, and they all make a promise, whoever gets there first is going to come back and tell the others. The end of the story tells that no one ever actually makes it, but Tip, the boy who told the story, is planning on taking his son there someday, because his son is now just as excited about the story as he was. I included this story because it's kind of the bridge between the childhood memories and the yearning for faraway places, and it captures that moment in all of our lives, I think, where there's some place we want to go. Before I say any more, is there any feedback for people who had a chance to read this? Things that struck you in the story, or any sense of familiarity, or?
I, for one, am very grateful that you offered it to us. And for those who haven't read it yet, do so, it's short. It takes us back to that time when term that the educators use in our formative time. These boys, six of them, some are a little older than others, were out in the western part of Nebraska, and the description is just marvelous. It just brings you. And you see these young guys, the kids, experiencing the sunset, experiencing the swimming, experiencing all that, but it's when they're gathering and sharing amongst their peers. And beautiful little word pictures have been painted to depict who these people are. And you can kind of sense what might be coming in the future. And then the one little guy talking about his uncle bring this tale back from far off New Mexico. I don't know that such a land exists. It's called an enchanted bluff or something. Might be part of this and part of that, but the way it was made to sound, this idyllic world existed someplace. It was high atop this cliff, and they found a way to get up and down to make it work. And there everything was beautiful. There everything was. All of them that we aspired to. And the way it's treated, you learn about the boys, you learn what becomes of them, you learn about their yearnings. I can learn how ultimately some of them never got out of town. And what becomes of them, but in their hearts and in their dreams, these images and that tale of that summer night still motivate them.
Thank you. Yeah, and there's more copies.
There was an Arthur thing that struck me.
Yeah.
I came from a small town, and when I got back to some of my class reunions, there was one kid in my high school class who I really admired. He was smarter than I was, a better athlete than anything. Who I always looked up to and envied. And he was the one who he actually became schizophrenic. He wound up never leaving town and staying and living with his parents and felt tragic. It reminded me of the Arthur situation.
Mm-hmm.
He had so many gifts. He had good hands and feet, a nice voice, but never left the backyard.
Yeah.
That's really emotional.
Yeah, this seemed like a real story. I mean, you could really picture the characters.
I didn't finish reading that one, I read the other one. But he just related happened in A school in the service. Maybe he was better off coming out, but this guy that he was came out first in the class, and then they said he was crazy, so he got out.
Oh, it's another tragic.
Yeah, I've struggled in the same area. I came in second in the class, and I should have got out too, probably. That's mediocre. Any organization is mediocre.
But I think the story of the enchanted cliff, the idea that here was this little Eden on top where they were safe, but they knew that. They really want that there is no hiding place like this.
Hi. We're just in New Mexico. We're
listening.
And I was thinking, we did go by the Enchanted Mesa, as well.
That's why I didn't do the story. Okay, I think we
It's just west of Albuquerque, and it's on the way to Acoma, Pueblo Village, which is on another. They're just mesas. I don't know how the story describes it. These are just like mesas right in the middle of nowhere, cliffs, and it's round.
Wow.
And that was the story that Acoma tour guides told us about, because you look over and see the Enchanted Mesa, and their village was built about the same mesa that almost looks the same. And until about 10, 15 years ago, there was no road to the top. They always had to take it, so they went down the little narrow, steep walkway down the side of the mesa.
It's sort of, I don't know, it brings a little bit of fiction to life.
It must have been written after she came back from New Mexico.
Yes, I think it was.
It's definitely a point on my visions map as well. As right out in the middle of it. This pops right out.
This is an aside, but how a woman could capture the boys and the boys' spirit so successfully is just
actually something I meant to say also about Ola Cather. She pushed the conventions of the time. She was. I've read a lot of her novels, and I'm not sure how to articulate it, but she wasn't a conventional lady in a time where there were ladies. And I think it comes through in the writing, and it's very fresh, still.
Oh yeah, she's...
Didn't she write Under a Pseudonym?
Under a Pseudonym.
Because of some of the...
She may have, I don't know, yeah. She's written extensively. I don't know that, but it could be.
I was trying to think back. Does she usually write from a male point of view? Because I think
Death comes for the Archbishop.
Death also, yeah, that is also.
I'm trying to think what else I've read.
She's.
Well, I've read Old Pioneer and Maya Antonia. And Old Pioneer was made into a television.
And is that a male point of view or a female? I can't remember.
I think that one's female.
That one's female.
And Song of a Lark is also from female point of view.
So
but also, a lot of times, it's just the narrative voice, not a character, so there's no gender. Mm-hmm. Well, I'd like to move us along to discuss Steinbeck story. And has anyone read, that was a lot much longer story. Did anyone have a chance to read all that? Instead of me telling the whole thing, maybe you all could just describe briefly what the story is about.
Well, it's the story of a farm family in Salinas Valley, California. And the young boy and his mother and father, and I can't remember if they're siblings. Or
No.
There's the farm worker guy. Billy.
The farm worker Billy, yeah. And the story centers on the boy and some nice details there too about how he has this relationship with the son. He's like a farm worker and he's excited about killing mice under the haystack. But then the main action of the story is the arrival of his grandfather, whose most important life event was leading a westering wagon train. And it's the mother's father. And the father, the boy's father, the son-in-law, is not thrilled he's coming because all he does is retell the same stories from the wagon train days. And the wife says to her husband, asks him to be kind because she says, don't you understand that was the moment he was made for? And once it was over, that was kind of the end of his life. And when he arrives, the grandson is thrilled to have him come because he tells stories about Indians and things. But in the process of his time there, the son-in-law sort of son-in-law is talking about how he wishes he would stop talking about this and how it's over and you've got, and the grandfather overhears him. And I guess I haven't processed too well what really happens, because he sort of says, he and the grandson then talk about, the grandson still wants to hear the stories, but some of the pride has been taken out of the grandfather by overhearing what his son-in-law said, and some of the joy has been taken out of the grandson's life, because he kind of sees his grandfather deflate in front of him, sort of. I've forgotten the very name.
That's really about it. The boy wants to, he's sad for his grandfather, and he offers to get him a glass of lemonade.
That's right.
And he goes.
Honesty all the way upstream of the son-in-law of saying, hey, it's over, let's get on with it. It catalyzes grandfather's processes a bit.
Yeah.
And in the end, when he's sharing with his grandson, he says, well, then he interprets details of this westerly move, and he comes up with some conclusions on what it means, and he said, maybe that's what I need to share. So he goes, closes this chapter, and he creates another mission for himself, basically.
So you see it as sort of just resolving it, maybe in kind of a semi-positive
way. He decides that he comes up and tells his grandson the meaning of all that experience, and then he said, well, maybe that's what, isn't that what they want to hear now?
Yeah.
That's true. I hadn't seen that as positive, but I suppose you're right.
So sometimes, rebuke of the wise is better than the praise of the fools. You could go on and tell somebody all day, oh, that sounds wonderful, or his dad, little boy's dad, says, it's over.
There were five characters in there, and I could have done what I wanted.
You say that?
Which there were five characters, starkly drawn, and I could have done very nicely without one of them.
You didn't like the father?
Not at all.
He was a grump. Yeah.
Well, he was worse than a grump. He was shutting down his kid.
Yeah, and you call him some Bridges.
Big Bridges.
Yeah, I didn't like that.
And he missed the whole picture. The grandpa had a touch of class. He was a Stephen Fowler. And we watched him die. He died right before our eyes. The funeral would be a little bit later, but his spirit went out by this cruel remark of the man who calls up himself as opposed to practicist, you know, by saying it's over. And Steinbeck really showed why he's regarded as such a good writer. Mm-hmm. He makes a big thing out of it. He comes as far as the ocean. Can't go beyond that. Yeah. But the interplay with people, there's a lot going on there, and I should think we'll leave everybody with the question, does it have to stop at the ocean? And aren't there other frontiers?
That's very good lead-in to where I want to go with this. I think it hasn't stopped, in fact, that space exploration is this decade or this generation's most significant step in the same direction. And I would like to just read you this section on Westring, because it actually gets into sort of a theological realm, and that's where I want to take off on the lecture. This is the grandfather explaining to the son after he's been deflated by the remark of his son-in-law. It wasn't Indians that were important, nor adventures, nor even getting out here. It was a whole bunch of people made into one big crawling beast, and I was the head. It was westering and westering. Every man wanted something for himself, but the big beast that was all of them wanted only westering. I was the leader, but if I hadn't been there, someone else would have been the head. The thing had to have a head. We carried life out here and set it down the way those ants carry eggs. And I was the leader. The westering was as big as God, and the slow steps that made the movement piled up and piled up until the continent was crossed. Jody, the little boy, says, well, maybe I could lead the people someday. And the old man smiled. There's no place to go. There's the ocean to stop you. There's a line of old men along the shore hating the ocean because it stopped them. No place to go, Jody. Every place is taken. But that's not the worst. Westering has died out of people. Westering isn't a hunger anymore. It's all done. Your father is right. It's finished. One of the questions I have for you all to think about, if there's time, we'll talk about it at the end, but do you think westering has died out? And I'm going to talk a little more about what I think the westering was about. First, I should say that I've gotten a lot of my ideas from a writer named Frederick Turner, who's a teacher of literature. And he actually steered me in the direction of these two stories. I don't agree with all of his analysis of American history and American spirituality, but I agree with some of it. And so some of what I have to say I've drawn from him. He points out that from the very beginning of the time that there were European American settlers here, that European visitors who came to this country noticed that the New World inhabitants seemed to have an itch, that the people here seemed uneasy and restless and rootless, always sort of moving towards something else. And Tocqueville was one of those writers. He described it as almost a frantic restlessness. It was as if those who had inherited the fruits of conquest and movement were unable to be content, and that there was no satisfaction in either possessing the land or in possessions on the land. And here's where I will interject. Turner says that he thinks that today we still seem to be the restless, rootless people who build our superhighways and continually are working every year, scrapping the old stuff and building the new. And the image that came to my mind was continual road construction and road repair. And maybe there's something to this. So it's maybe it's not westering in the sense of leading a wagon train. Maybe it's building bigger and newer highways. Maybe that's the journeying that's happening now. He points out that it's remarkable that while this continent basically had the same landscape from the Stone Age until the beginning of the European settlers, and that from the time the first white settlers came, the landscape was changed dramatically in only 3 centuries. So the Stone Age landscape was shaped in the short span of 300 years to resemble a modern European civilization. So the settlers came, and part of what they did, they transformed it, they cultivated it, and I think it's really interesting to think of the terms that are used to describe that process. The land was tamed, it was settled, and when you think about it, maybe the beast wasn't the mass of people, maybe the beast was really the wilderness that European settlers felt the need to tame. For me, the really important question is, why did it need to be tamed? What was it that needed to be settled? And if you think of your American history lessons, there was the very reality of dangers in the frontier, of wild animals and native peoples who didn't want their land taken away from them. And so there was a certain amount of taming and shaping that had to happen for new people to exist on the land. But I also think that there is a deeper level of the need for civilization, the need for taming. And it goes back to thinking about our Judeo-Christian tradition. In our stories, the desert usually doesn't come across as a very positive place. The wilderness is a place of wandering. It's a place of temptation. It's a place where Satan is encountered. And I think that there actually has been a spiritual shirking from wilderness, and that civilization is a place that is civilized is then safe, and it's the spiritual home. And that is that aspect of our spiritual life has been shaped by fear of the desert, by fear of the wildness. Now I'm going to throw out another idea here, and this actually is also in our tradition, and that is the tradition of the desert fathers and mothers of the early church who went out into the desert to be away from civilization, to be able to really grapple with what it meant to lay down your life for Christ whenever you weren't being persecuted by outside forces anymore. And that in that time, the desert actually became a place where the holy could be experienced. I think in our modern time, because many of us live in urban areas and because our lives are so civilized, that wilderness takes on another important aspect, and that is because it's a place of mystery, and it's a little bit of wildness left. And I'm really, by nature, more of a bookworm than I am a hiker. But I'm going to make myself go on that hike tomorrow because every time I do that, I experience a little bit of that wonder and mystery and wildness. And I know that is a spiritual need. people find it in different ways. But I think for our time, significance of wilderness is really important. And it means overcoming some of the history, much of our history. I have an exercise for us, but before I do that, I'd just like to read a bit from Henry David Thoreau. And I read him, and it's very interesting. You can tell the attitude toward landscape and wilderness by white Americans was not seen as valuable and profitable, or value, it was profitable, but not valuable in the sense of spirit valuable until the 19th century. And I think what happened then was the land had already changed so much. That was when they started preserving parks. And Thoreau said that we need the tonic of the wilderness. We need to witness our own limits transgressed. And there's a description in Walden when he finally comes to a mountain in Maine. Who is it that I know from Maine? Oh, it's Joe. Great. Anyway, it's a mountain there. And he found the reality that he had heroically sought, the confrontation with the other that had always been what he suspected is that unspoken treasure in the New World. He wrote, "I looked with awe at the ground I trod on to see what the powers had made there, the form and fashion and material of their work. This was that earth of which we have heard, made out of chaos and old night. Here was no man's garden, but the untamed globe. It was not lawn, nor pasture, nor woodland, nor arable, nor wasteland. It was the fresh and natural surface of the planet Earth, as it was made forever and ever. Talk of mysteries. Think of our life in nature daily to come in contact with it. Rocks, trees, wind on our cheeks, the solid earth, the actual world." So I think he was finding that in untouched nature, there were revelations of the divine that was essential, certainly for his spiritual life, and I suspect maybe for many of us, or else we wouldn't all be here.
I just wanted to react. I'm not sure I understood exactly what you were saying about the biblical interpretation of wilderness. Because while it's true that in the Bible the wilderness is a place of testing and of temptation, I don't know if I would agree that the Bible disparages that experience. That it seems to me, I think I would see the opposite in terms of how much of the biblical narrative takes place in the book.
That's true.
And that in a, you know, well, it's a very difficult place of vulnerability and extreme hardship at times. It seems to me that the harshest judgment in the scripture is against the cities, places of prosperity, against wealth and ease. When we were in Israel, we heard a fascinating interpretation done by a geographer between land of milk and land of honey.
Oh.
I'll talk to you about that in my future if you'd like to hear about
it. I would.
But certainly the hardship of the wilderness is described in the Bible, but I just wanted to read.
Yeah, I guess I was thinking about the Israelites coming out of Egypt and it being in the wilderness that they already, you know, while Moses was receiving the Ten Commandments, they're already worshiping other gods. But I agree that then they're forced to wander for a long time. But yeah, you're right. There's judgment against the wealth of the cities.
Well, the same thing happened in Babylon.
Yeah.
You know, where they started mingling with the natives and so on. Yeah. But when they went to cities, they didn't worship Baal.
That's so true. That's true.
It's sort of like they fell apart wherever they were.
Yeah. That's true.
But when Jesus is forced, you know, when he goes out to struggle with Satan, it's not in a city. I mean, he does go out to the wild place, the deserted place, you know, because I think that there's a couple different wilderness traditions, because certainly the 40 years of wandering in the wilderness was purposeful, you know.
As was Jesus kind of.
Yeah, but I mean, Satan was, I think it's kind of a lot of different things about the wilderness. But I hadn't thought about that about the
Yeah, it's interesting. It's funny, it just reminds me, the opposite is when I went to seminary in San Anselmo, which is in Marin County in San Francisco Bay Area, and it's the only, there's a consortium of 8 or 9 seminaries, I can't remember, and they're all located in Berkeley, except for the Presbyterian one, which is in Marin County. And when it was built, the only way to get to and from that school was, there was a ferry that you took from San Francisco to get across the bay. And it was intentional. The seminary looks like a monastery. It's incredibly beautiful. But it was built away from the sinful city. They wanted their seminarians to be pure and unstained by the city. And I think we tend to look at cities more that way now. But I think you're right. There's different ways of looking at this.
Like the wilderness, rather than taking on a character of its own, good or bad, it offers a situation, and if you want to, an opportunity. You will remember being expressions about being cast out into the wilderness. As you said, Paul, purposeful. You go there to do something, to have an encounter. And the real tragedy, I should think, is that we have such a tendency to transform the wilderness, and we need wilderness. Mm-hmm. What is it, about 6 blocks from us right now? We need wilderness in order to conduct certain essential business.
And what are we going to do if we ever drive out wilderness? It's like getting rid of oxygen.
Yeah.
We need to have it, but then we also need to know what to do, not so much with it, but what to do when we get the presence of it.
Yeah. And maybe the knowledge is knowing we need it. I mean, I think, because if we know we need it, we're gonna go there, and then we'll find out what happens. But let me ask just back to the question of, do you think westering is still happening?
Yes.
Can you say more?
Well, we became friends this summer with a retired couple. But this comic description of why they don't let my NRV. And one of the things that they observe in so many of their counterparts who have them is they don't keep them very long. They trade them in for a bigger RV with a little more luxurious equipment. And they keep that sense of expansiveness, which when you were talking about the restlessness that kept, no value sort of in. And a number of people I know who have them and don't use them.
Yeah.
But it's...
Yeah, that's very funny. I've got to admit, my husband and I spent a week, we have every year a family camp that our congregation is involved in, along with some other Presbyterian churches, at a state park on the coast. And, you know, this is not bragging, it just shows that we haven't been married long and we don't have children, but we have a tent, a little tent, and a little tiny hiker cook stove and 2 little lawn chairs, and we were really amazed as we walked around the camp at the way people made it home. just everything you can imagine. And I think we were both a little bit appalled, because it was just such a contrast, and maybe a little bit embarrassed that ours looked so small. And then I was really amused, because the whole week my husband kept saying, well, maybe we could get a car and take the seats out and, put a stove. And it's that same thing. It's like this wanting to somehow, now that we've seen what it could be, or the direction, wanting to just grow a little. And
totally lose touch with the wilderness.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
Or the number of toys that are available with which to enjoy them on Earth.
Yeah.
And then you buy them,
yeah.
And then there's this pressure to use them. So you can't just go
sit
and read.
That's right.
I think there's kind of two things. I think our current society is always, people always like to travel.
Mm-hmm.
And, if somebody knows that they have a limited time to live, one of the things in their agenda is always to travel. So,
mm-hmm.
I think all of us want to see different places.
Mm-hmm.
But I think one of the kind of pathetic things that's happening today is that people are traveling to try to keep from being uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, people are basically, when I was a kid, nobody in the northern tier of the country went south.
Mm-hmm.
Now everybody does. Now people who are retired think people that stay home in the Dakotas and Minnesota and Wisconsin are crazy.
They're
crazy.
Mm-hmm.
And we've all gone to kind of California, Arizona. Now we're going to have to go to Arkansas. But now the people in California are getting uncomfortable with stuff down there, and they're coming up to folks.
That's true.
And it's I don't think it's wanderlust. I think it's kind of a
escapism.
It's an escapism.
Yeah.
And it's
a return to the wilderness.
And boy, but they're leaving a lot behind. They're leaving
that's
a
true.
Lifetime of community. They're
yes.
leaving their churches. Maybe
yes.
they think that's some people that I can't believe what they're doing.
Yeah.
What with the last 10 years of their life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, at 65 and 70, they're leaving their kids and their community and their churches behind to go someplace warm, for goodness sakes.
But also maybe to escape the reality of I'm going to lose all this. Maybe I've got 10 years left to live.
Good conditioning for living it all. So.
Yeah,
they're not burdening their kids with their company of their old stories anymore. So it's a blessing. Only there's one problem I was reading. I can't remember if it was this book or society needs a certain amount of structure and stability, and we're getting so much migration going on and people just going west to the coast or whatever that it's sort of like compare the whole American society as a boat.
Mm-hmm.
And people are all running to one side of the boat too much, and it's causing the whole society to pitch pretty seriously at times.
Or
rock.
One of the fastest growing counties in Wisconsin is up in the boondocks in northwestern Wisconsin.
Yeah.
And now we're getting a reverse snowboard effect. We're actually getting people where it's too hot in Arizona.
Mm-hmm.
They're coming up for the winter, for the summer. And building cabins in the summer.
It's a little crazy, isn't it?
I think that's great.
The other thing is thinking about when you talked about the reasons we travel. That is so significant for me is how much of it is external.
Mm-hmm.
External kind of stimulation, the comfort outside.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing about being in the wilderness is the power it has to force us and to see ourselves. Another story I can tell you in more detail, it won't take a lot of time. One of my favorite cousins was a Benedictine nun for 13 years. And she's no longer a nun, and she has a family. When they were at Disney World, Disney World was conducting a research thing, thinking about getting into community, model community living, education, and other kinds of things. If you had to have a master's degree and be a certain age and all these things, Marie qualified. So she got in on this research project. And then talk to them about how everything at Disney World is so external. It's so outside of you. And it is choreographed to the T. It is beautiful in a certain kind of way. But it never asks you to look at yourself.
Yeah.
Or to give anything of yourself.
Yeah.
Not when she said, I gave you a good Benedictine view of the world. It's wonderful.
Well, see, that actually... And I have to confess here, I'm talking about something that I'm not doing. I'm drawn toward being rooted, but I flirt with the idea of moving a lot. Every time I go to a new place that intrigues me, like Holden, or back to Kentucky where my parents live, I think, oh, well, maybe we can move here, you know? It's sort of, I think it's genetic, but... there's something that I'm discovering about the need to be rooted and to make the commitment to be there and then to just deal with whatever comes up. You know, I mean, maybe that sounds like taking the medicine, you know, But I mean, it's that's not been my experience in my life. I've moved a lot, but I'm just getting to this point where I think maybe there's something about really developing a mature spiritual life. Maybe it's not staying exactly in the same place, but committing to some things in your life long enough. I suspect that's a lot of what parenthood is about.
I'm just reacting to your need to move, because that's what you've done. That's been your experience. And mine is absolutely the opposite. Mm-hmm. I grew up on a farm in Minnesota that was homesteaded by Norwegians mm-hmm. in 1872. And my parents and my brother started the farm. Mm-hmm. And I have deep, deep roots there. And I mean, I still cry when I leave it sometimes, you know? It's my home, those are my woods, and so on. But I look at my parents and now at the next generation, my brother and his family, and don't really long to stay right there, because I've experienced other things in life and I'm glad for them. But sometimes when it hits me most is when there's a crisis. Mm-hmm. And I mean, the community is just there. Mm-hmm. And it's just taken for granted in a sense. Not taken advantage of, but mm-hmm. it is there. Mm-hmm. So my dad had hepatitis. We'll plant the crop for you, mm-hmm. you know? Mm-hmm. And that's something that those of us who are on the move, mm-hmm. I don't think we experience. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, we experience more adventures than they develop. Yeah. You know, and so I'm kind of just in the process of weighing that out.
Yeah.
But primarily, I'm a person who wants to have roots. Mm-hmm. And we're, even the summer, we've been on the go. Mm-hmm. But I can tell, when we've gotten back from mm-hmm. 3 days of camping or 3 weeks in Alaska, mm-hmm. we came back to our little cabin. Mm-hmm. I can settle. Mm-hmm. Even making shallow roots felt good to me.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You had a very long time.
What did I do to you?
I think there's another sense of westering. It's inward. Mm-hmm. That it isn't all geography. Mm-hmm. And we've been mm-hmm. thinking geographically. Mm-hmm. There is a... Grandpa was wrong. There's certainly more places to go. I look back at that SOB Carl, and he had a lot of work to do. He had a lot of inwarding work to do. Mm-hmm. He was the stereotypical insensitive male mm-hmm. type. He never fit a hole in the wall. Never lived. But the ultimate wilderness is what the comedian George Gobel said, no matter where you go, there you are. And the ultimate wilderness, whether you're in find yourself a hospital bed or all alone in an expensive hotel room or whatever, there you are. And the appeal of Hildegard of Bingen, just the big one, a mystic, and someone who wasn't thinking about moving someplace and the need to cut trees and make roads and put it into other facilities and stuff, but who was rooted physically near Bingen, but what she explored was so vast it had no boundaries. And I think we're being invited to do that. And in that sense, there is no ocean that will stop us.
That's tomorrow's class. So you gotta
I'm
come.
Sorry.
No. You should be please come.
Yeah. I want to respond to what I forgot my Susan's was, because my experience was kind of just the opposite, and in that the longest I'd ever lived in one spot was 5 years. And my grandfather had been a pioneer Lutheran pastor who was from northern Wisconsin to Salt Lake City, Utah, and Cheyenne, and that's what my father. So we were of that frontier sort of family, and always moving.
And it was really to be a recovered Westerling and maybe start thinking of it. When we decided, when I married the wrong person, stuck in one place. When I looked at settling in one place in Duluth, Minnesota for the rest of my life, I mean, there was a panic reaction to that. There really was a panic reaction to that. No, it wasn't the place. It was one place, you know. Because we had decided, we'd been in Southern California, we'd been in West Virginia, I'd been in New Jersey, I'd been in Chicago, I'd been in a lot of places, and Duluth was fine. It was one place was the problem. And it was interesting how panicky that was for me. And I think it still has been important for my tolerating that to have lots of opportunities to travel and things, but it has been a real experience to put down roots.
How long have you been there?
19 years.
Okay, wow.
And it's been a very good feeling, I would say, to be part of a place and actually making a difference in place and that sense of community and all that. But it was really a very scary feeling to kind of say, well, we're probably going to be here. You know?
Yeah.
Now I think I might have heard it coming above and changing because I kind of know what it is to constantly be moving.
Something you said is another aspect of this that I've been thinking about, and that is when a whole society of people has been moving around, is there sort of like running to one side of the ship? Because there aren't a lot of people rooted in their place, I think that's one of the reasons why our care for the earth and our care for our space is not as strong as it once was. And we haven't even talked about technology. I kind of want to stay away from that, but that's part of it too. I mean, farming changed dramatically in my grandfather's days. And so he, even though he was rooted in one place, things changed a lot in the way he related to the farm because of the equipment. And the market, you know, that whole picture. But I think, you know, there are individual preferences and feelings about how we feel more comfortable staying or moving. But that as a society, our country, I read this in an article, I don't know the statistics, but it said that we move more than any other society. We have the freedom in this country to choose where we want to live. And in exchange for sense of rootedness and inner harmony with our surroundings, we can choose higher pay and achievements and the excitement of seeing different places and the adventure of a new place. But that as a whole country, that's probably been one of the things that has sped up shaping this country to fit us, shaping the land rather than us being shaped.
Yeah, you can always, if you dirty up one place, you can always go to another.
Yeah, that's
or
happened.
Or use one place up.
And use it up, right. And
well, we that's a classic example.
Yeah.
The old farmer in Iowa said to the county agent, the young whippersnapper, what have you got to tell me? I've already used up three farms, and I'm working on the fourth. he spoke from experience, but what you spoke about 300 years, you know, it's had, I think we could broaden it in the history of the world, of making allowances for the nomads and hunters and gatherers. For the most part, the globe was people in pockets. In West Virginia, they call a hollow, another place called a draw, it's a place of canyon. A few minutes ago, we were talking about this enchanted plaza, this enchanted cliff. We've been kind of deposited, whether it's on the farm in Minnesota or some other place. And this is an option that is recently opened to us. And we just do it. It's like water running freely down here. But what will be the consequences of all this? I think we reacted to it.
Yeah.
Well, the sameness is the threat.
Yeah,
that frightens me. I'm in danger of the environment. It's the sameness that frightens me the most.
It is really scary. I've talked about my trip back after 16 years to the town I grew up in for 8 years in Tennessee. And the big shock was the huge freeway that hadn't been there before. And the view from the freeway is the tallest McDonald's sign I've ever seen. This huge golden arches and, you know, all the familiar malls. It looked like a suburb of Portland. You know, and that was distressing. Well, I hate to end it on a sad note, but I've got for Thursday and Friday a chapter from Kathleen Norris's book called Dakota. And this chapter's called Frontier. I'll pass
it.
Yeah, okay. If you're not, you are free to take one. If you don't want one, pass them along.
What time are you teaching them?
I'm 3:45. Mm-hmm. I think this next door. And also, I have another. I threw in one story that my husband kept telling me. He goes, "You shouldn't use that. You shouldn't use that. It doesn't fit." But I copied anyway because I love it. It's a story by John Muir from a book called Muir Among the Animals. Tomorrow's session is about the internal journey, the Westering inside. And really the only connection with this John Muir story is it's incredible. It's a struggle between life and death. And that's what Muir encountered a lot in his ramblings, roamings in the wilderness. So that element is in here. Besides, it's just incredibly beautiful. It's very descriptive of the wilderness. And the part I like most of all is his companion in this journey is a dog. And it's I've never really read anything that a dog was a character in before in such a nice way. So if you would like, I'll just leave this on this table as you go out. If you would like a copy, I won't really be referring to it tomorrow, but you may find it helpful for next week. Okay, so that's right.
So one is Frontier, and that is our Dakota, and that is...
There's two chapters. I may have copied two chapters. And it says Frontier on it. That's
no, yeah, that was so funny.
I gave you these are two other stories. This is Annie Dillard.
We went to
Also before you leave, I've got if you want the Steinbeck or the Cather, they're both here. And there's also a bibliography of materials, and so I have to carry all these out of here unless you take them. And I've already bought more books than I have room for, so please take them. And if not, I'll take them and use them in another class. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good discussion.